Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's programs, fossils at Wally's Beach. When water was drained from the St. Mary's Reservoir in southern Alberta, what emerged were animal tracks, bones, and Clovis spearheads dating back over 11,000 years. Two archaeologists from the University of Calgary talk about how this discovery will change our view of the new world at the end of the Ice Age. Also from the University of Calgary, Dr. Nasser Elshimi. He is researching a new system using GPS and thermal imaging to detect hotspots in forest fires, something we may see lots of this summer. And historian Dr. Sandy Gao looks at how safety and living conditions have changed in the oil patch. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. One day in 1997, a school teacher by the name of Shane Tolman took his young sons for a picnic at Wally's Beach. This is what the locals call a stretch of sand and mud along St. Mary's Reservoir near Cardston. The reservoir had recently been drained to allow repairs on a spillway. While his sons played, the teacher poked around in the mud and found an old spearhead. This was the beginning of one of the most significant archaeological finds in Alberta's history. With a little encouragement, the school teacher became a grad student under Dr. Len Hills, a paleontologist and professor emeritus in geology and geophysics at the University of Calgary. With radiocarbon dating, Len Hills dated the site back to 11,350 years ago. The area is rich in artifacts, including Clovis spear points and hundreds of fossilized animal tracks, including a now-extinct horse, camel, and woolly mammoth. For Len Hills, the site gives an unprecedented picture of the interaction between prehistoric animals.
Everything we'd found up to that point was known to have been here living in Alberta at that time. But when you find them in gravel pits or you find them there, they've been reworked, they've moved around, and you never get a sense of community. And so when you start seeing the tracks, well, then this adds a new dimension. You can see what the animals are doing. They're walking, or they're running, or they're feeding. You can, for example, with the mammoth, we always made parallels or correlated it with the actions of elephants. How they walked was what we assumed for mammoth. Well, with these tracks and the hundreds that have subsequently come up, we can now say that, yes, indeed, they walked that way. We can also say that they walked across the area, and every once in a while they stand around and produce packed grounds where they just stood around either to digest their food or to socialize. And so now we have for the mammoth direct evidence that they did behave much like an elephant. What it also tells us is that the tracks are all coming from the same, exactly the same horizon. So you find a track of a woolly mammoth, you find a track of a camel, or a track of a horse, and we even have one or two tracks of caribou. We know that they were at that locality at exactly that same time. So then now you can start to reconstruct the environment. We know that it was, at that time, was a large island. There was a branch of the St. Mary River that's now abandoned that swung around the site. And that, on the one side, it was a relatively gentle slope. And this is where the tracks were focused. There's a gentle slope down to water on the one on the south side, and a very steep, almost precipitous slope on the other side. So we started seeing that the animals were moving back and forth. But when you stood there and looked at the distribution of the tracks, you could, in actual fact, recreate a realistic scene for what was taking place there. You could have a small herd of woolly mammoth in one area, a herd of horses standing around or grazing, a herd of caribou, off in the distance might be a bison, and wandering through, and right next to the woolly mammoth tracks, you had camel.
That was paleontologist Dr. Len Hills. Another member of the St. Mary's research team is archaeologist Dr. Brian Koyman. The University of Calgary was abuzz last week when Brian's group revealed that they had evidence from the site that early humans hunted and butchered horses. There were smashed bones and, more important, two Clovis points that showed traces of horse blood even after 11,000 years.
The horse skeletons that we have are in a pretty narrow area, pretty small area, just a few hundred meters, you know, say about 150 meters of each other. There's probably half a dozen of them. They're just, you know, back from the edge of the ancient river valley, and it's very close to this, or right at this spot where, as Len was talking about, there's a shallower, an easier way for animals to get in and out of the valley, and lots of tracks there. And it's just like right at the spot where animals are probably moving. And if people were going to hunt them, this is exactly the kind of place they might want to ambush them. So it's the perfect spot for it in that sort of sense. So we found initially when we were working on the horse skeletons, excavating them, we didn't find anything. Then Len, who was more persistent maybe than some of the archaeologists, one day he was working on some of the material, and he was coming back to photograph the next day. And so he knew what was there, and then the next day he came back, and the wind had actually excavated some around the horses, and he found some stone tools in association with one of the horses. And that was just staggering. It was just so neat. We did more work on the horses, and eventually we found one horse in particular that had some excellent evidence for actually butchering the horse. We had some flake tools, some flakes of stone that had sharp edges that would have been used for butchering an animal. We had found a bone that had cut marks on it, and we found a huge cobble, about the size of your head, sitting in the middle of a vertebral column, the backbone of the horse. And it had split the backbone into two pieces, and underneath were some crushed vertebrae. So it just like they'd smashed it to maybe in the butchering process and then just left it there. And so we had some good evidence, but we didn't have any of the weapons associated with them. And this is where the Clovis points come in. In the material that Shane had found, and additional material we had found as our investigations went on, we had Clovis points.
What has been the previous thought about horses at that time? Were they used by humans who were around at that time or not?
In the past, the assumption has been that they were not used by humans. And that's the key thing about what we have been able to find at the Wally's Beach site down in the St. Mary's Reservoir, is that we actually have the stone tools in association, simple stone tools, not complex ones, but, you know, more expedient ones like you might, you know, make on the spot and just use to butcher an animal. We have those associated with the horse bones. And then the second thing we did was we did the residue analysis on the spear points to see if we could make that connection.
Now, what's a residue analysis? How do you do that?
Okay, it's residue analysis is basically, if you think of any stone tool that people used, whatever they were using on, whether they're cutting up an animal or scraping plants or whatever, there's going to be some of the tissue of that animal or that plant left on the tool. Now, in many cases, that's going to degrade over the years. But usually there are little sort of deeper spots on the surface of the tool where there's a little scar or something like that, and a little bit of collects in there, dries on, and hardens. And there's been a PhD was done by a person called Margaret Newman, who's an archaeologist here at the University of Calgary, where she used forensic analysis techniques to actually detect these small amounts of residue left on stone tools. And then the results came back, and on two of the Clovis points, they actually got horse residue. And it was just, we just didn't expect it.
Now, how could that last all these 11,000 years?
It takes probably conditions that are probably quite dry. In sites that are wet or waterlogged, we never get any residues preserved. So it has to be a dry site, maybe where things, just like a scab, you know, when you scrape yourself or something like that, the blood coagulates and you get sort of a protective barrier. And if something like that happens and then the material is buried quite rapidly, which does seem to be the case here at our site, at the Wally's Beach site, then those kind of circumstances are the best ones for preservation. And the amounts of material that are preserved are extremely small. I mean, you can't see any traces. When you look at these things, even usually under a microscope, you can't see any traces of the residue that's left, the protein residue that's left. So it's pretty unusual.
That was archaeologist Dr. Brian Koyman of the University of Calgary. Before that, I spoke with paleontologist and professor emeritus Dr. Len Hills. Also involved in the research team is PhD student Paul McNeil and, of course, the man who discovered the St. Mary's site, Shane Tolman. The group is working in a race against time to collect as much data as they can before the reservoir floods in 3 or 4 weeks. Coming up, a marriage between GPS and thermal imaging to fight forest fires. When it comes to fighting forest fires, the most critical aspect is the initial attack. But heavy smoke often keeps water bomber pilots from getting an accurate fix on where they should dump water to put out the fires. Now, a geomatics researcher at the University of Calgary is working on a system that would meld global positioning with thermal imaging technology, giving water bomber pilots a real-time map of the advancing fire's hotspots. I spoke with Dr. Nasser Elshimi about his project.
Currently, most of the techniques used in detecting forest fire is mainly using a spotter aircraft. And this spotter aircraft usually have a navigation chart and a navigator observing the forest. Okay, and what the navigator is usually doing is looking for smoke. Okay, and then reporting this smoke again to the forest fire information system. But this technique is definitely have difficulties in detecting the actual position of the fire, especially if the smoke is very heavy, and therefore there is also a lot of errors because of the mainly based on human vision, and as you know, definitely human vision could be mistaken in some cases. So the objective, as I mentioned, is to come up with something based on vision which is beyond our human vision, and this is mainly making use of thermal imaging, because thermal imaging, their principle simply is to detect temperature, and as you know, hotspots and forest fires definitely have higher temperature than the background.
So what is it that you're actually trying to do?
To integrate new navigation techniques based on global positioning system and inertial navigation with the up-to-date technology in thermal imaging.
Okay. Is this relatively new?
The thermal imaging is currently used mainly for military application for reconnaissance. GPS is simply used in all different applications. Inertial system is simply a military technique for navigation underground, underwater. So putting these things together is the new idea. Okay, but all the technologies that have been there for a long time, but putting them together in this application, I think is new.
What are you actually doing then to pull all of this together? Are there some problems or obstacles that you have to overcome?
The first step is simply to come up with the specification of the thermal band which we'll be using for detecting the hotspots. So this is the first thing. And what we did is did some analysis based on images collected last year in Vancouver. And from there, we find out the best window. We call it the thermal window. And based on that, we choose the proper equipment. After that, is how to put these things together in a reliable way, and also how to process the images in real time. Because what we're using is based on the video standard. We're collecting 30 images per second. Okay, and we have to come up with a very reliable and very fast technique to process these images in real time, detect the images in real time, detect the hotspots and the forest fire in real time, compute the coordinates again in real time, and sending everything about the hotspots and their perimeters, how they are propagating in real time to the forest information center.
Now, I've seen inside these spotter planes and also the tankers, and they're very small spaces, and there's a lot of instrumentation. I can't even imagine having something else there, and as you're flying quickly over, trying to figure out all of these different things, how do you deal with that?
First of all, yeah, you're right. Definitely, the most of the spotters are helicopters, and space is very is one of the limitation. But what we're trying to come up with is a very small, lightweight, low-cost sensor systems. Like we are currently, the camera itself is less than 200 gram, and the size is very small. What we're trying to come up with is a very small inertial system. Inertial system is the bottleneck for this application. And we are testing currently a new inertial system based on what we call micro-machine technology. And these type of sensors are the size of for example, 5 centimeter by 5 centimeter by 5 centimeter, which is really is not burden in terms of the size and weight and for this type of helicopter. GPS receivers are right now they're becoming more and more smaller. So we're trying to come up with very small. I know this limitation, but we're trying to come up with very small systems so that we could put it in aircraft, helicopters, and any type of spotters.
Have you had to do anything special to enhance the images? I would think that even with all the thermal imagery, there's still an awful lot of smoke down there. Would that somehow get in the way of what you need to do?
Yeah, I think you're right. Definitely there is a lot of challenges. One of them is definitely to separate the hot spots from the smoke. And this, I think, is not very difficult. But the other issue is sometimes, especially in if we have very high trees, that the hot spots sometimes are obliqued by the trees themselves. And what we try to do in these cases is try to go in circles around the area so that we could have some sort of panoramic view about this about the forest fires. And also what we're trying to do right now is developing new techniques for monitoring the motion of the hot spots. But first we have to remove our motion first. So we remove the motion of the aircraft, and then from that we could detect the motion of hot spots. And by doing that, we'll be able to detect the same hot spot from maybe 10-20 images. Okay, and by doing that, we'll be able to come up with the coordinates of these hotspots on the images, and then we could transfer that by using the GPS and INS into 3D coordinates on the ground.
You have some stuff up on your computer screen. Can you explain to me what this means?
The first window on the screen is simply the original thermal images, and as you see, they are not very normal and not usual for our human vision. The second one is simply a simple what we call thresholding. So what by doing thresholding, we are throwing the background, which is simply the thermal characteristic of the trees, and all what we end up with is the thermal characteristic of the hotspots. Okay? The third one is simply what we call a variance filter type, and this is variance filter. We try to accumulate all the pixels in the image which have the same thermal characteristics. And as you see here, that there is white circles, and these white circles are the hotspots themselves because they have definitely much higher temperature than the background.
So once you filter all that background out, you can really see how it brings out the image of where the hotspots are. In the other ones, you hardly see it at all.
Yeah, definitely. The hotspot definitely shows very clearly.
What would be the advantage or the benefit to the people who are fighting fires?
I think the most advantage of this system is simply the knowing the exact location of the forest fire at the initial phase of attacking the forest fire. Because most of the I read a lot of stories about forest fire fighting, and the initial attack is the most important one. So if we be able to attack the forest fires at the initial stage in a very strong way and an accurate way, I think we'll be able to control the fire before it propagates.
I would think that if your project works, that this would also save an awful lot of money.
Of course. Not only that, it will save also life, because the one of the critical issues after controlling the fire is cleaning up, which is call it the mop up of the forest fires. And there is a lot of situation where you have to send people in areas where there's still hot, very hot spots or there is fires. So what we, the other application of the system is that after we control the forest fire, we go again and take some images and we detect the hot spots which again cannot be seen by the human eyes. And by that definitely we save a lot of life, we save a lot of effort, and we could direct again the water bomber to this area. So it's time and also life.
Well, I certainly wish you all the luck, especially with, it looks like we might have a good forest fire season this year with all the dry weather.
I mean, although we don't hope to have forest fires, but at least for testing the system, I would like to have a controlled one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Nasser El-Shimi, an assistant professor in geomatics engineering at the University of Calgary. Next, a step back in time to the early reckless days of Alberta's oil patch. When farm boys became roughnecks in Alberta's oil patch, they survived by their wits and physical strength. Safety regulations and special equipment were unheard of in the early days. There were no steel-toed boots or hard hats to protect them from falling pipes and knocks to the head. As historian Dr. Sandy Gow reflects, given the conditions, it's a wonder anyone survived their time in the oil patch.
The deaths were it's really demoralizing to read these statistics, and these aren't government statistics that I have come across for the most part until the 1950s. Before that time, I read them about them in the newspapers, and the maiming and the deaths were horrific. People were safety equipment was almost non-existent. Nobody wore a hard hat. Belts ran without any protective shields over them. There were no hydrogen sulfide detectors, and men were gassed quite regularly. There were some very bad gassings in Turner Valley in the early days. People were catching their hands in machinery and losing them and having their bodies smashed up against parts. It was really, really, really nasty stuff. And when I was young, I worked on a service rig, and I had the draw works collapse and kill a friend of mine. And I can remember how depressing and how startling it was to have this happen. But that was a rarity in Redwater area in the 1950s to have those sort of deaths. But up until the mid-40s, the provincial government didn't have safety regulations to cover drilling rigs. And a man in Edmonton here, Doug Gibbs, had just got out of the Navy, and he was an electrician. And he was approached while he was working at the bus company by the provincial government, would he take over as a safety inspector for them? So he was part and parcel of the group who wrote up the first set of safety regulations for rigs in Alberta. And the Alberta government, to their credit, the Department of Labor, really began to clamp down on safety regulations. The only problem was there were never enough safety inspectors to go around. And deaths still continued. 1955 was a terrible year. I think there was something like 18 people died that year. And the accidents, if you talk to some of the old drillers, they will say to you that accidents are normally due, number one, to poor training. You don't train the people to show them what the hazards are. And number two, carelessness. Those two, more than anything else, maimed and killed people on drilling rigs. Today, the standards are very tight. And there are substantial fines, it's my understanding, for a modern rig if you don't have certain things put into place.
Well, the oil patch has a reputation for a very hard lifestyle, and certainly that would have contributed it somewhat, do you not think, to the carelessness or the negligence or the accidents that happened?
Well, especially if somebody came to work drunk, yes. And there are definitely cases of that. The drillers have mentioned that sort of thing. And any good driller would, as they say in the business, run him off or tell him to go get his head down and try and get somebody else to work his shift for him.
What was the life like for the drillers and the oil riggers being out there in those really rough conditions and in those more primitive times?
Well, it was usually the case that in southern Alberta, especially around Turner Valley and around Wainwright, you built tar paper shacks, or you built, you could even take wooden granaries and try and live in those. And you lived pretty rough. You had a camp cook whose job it was to cook for you. You were lucky if it was a woman, because she normally knew how to cook, but some of the men they got as cooks, who were the only ones who would put up with going out into these areas where they were pretty infamous. And the meals were very bland. There was nothing very pleasant about them. A lot of beans, a lot of bread, no milk. Sometimes the fresh water was pretty bad. The places in the wintertime were cold because they weren't insulated. At best, you could hope for some sawdust in the walls and some newspapers put across it to try and break the wind and that sort of thing. No plumbing, of course. You had to run out to a toilet outside, which wasn't very comfortable. And in the early days, men worked 12-hour shifts rather than 8-hour shifts. That 8-hour shift didn't come in till later on, about 1928, 29, I think, somewhere in there. Otherwise, you worked long hours in a boring location, usually, because you were far from town, and you simply didn't have a very pleasant lifestyle. You had no washing facilities. You had to do your own wash your own clothing and that. And so it became very popular to just simply wash your clothing in gasoline and then hang it out, because that was the only way you could get the oil out of it. The soap would not take the oil out. And there's very an infamous tale about Leduc number 1, where one of the crew washed his overalls in gasoline and then hung them up in the boiler house to dry, and the boiler house caught on fire. So the conditions very often were not very good at all. They only began to really begin to improve. You really see the first improvement in the late 1950s, early 1960s, because you're short of men and you want something appealing and you're starting to move up north in isolated places, and you begin to hire really, really good cooks, build decent accommodations for the men, and you also want to get yourself a crew which will stay, and very often the cook is the key to that. And catering companies began to appear, and they took over the job of feeding the crews for the oil companies. And there were a number of catering companies run out of Edmonton and Calgary which did this. And some of these roughnecks, who could be a bit of a pain, knew that if they went into the kitchen, if they didn't behave, they got thrown out and they didn't get fed. So it had a rather cooling impact on their rather hot dispositions. If they wanted to eat, they had to behave in the mess hall. And this made for a big change, apparently.
That was Dr. Sandy Gao, a history professor at Concordia University College in Edmonton. Sandy is writing a book on changes in oil field technology. And this segment of Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. And if you ordered fabric bird nests from Holly Newman's Nesting Project, which I talked about on an earlier program, send me an email and let me know how yours are doing. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.